Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been a week of scary market news, Sarah Palin fever, and big hurricane fears in Texas. Lehman Brothers, the giant Wall Street investment bank, scrambled to save itself, joining a parade of meltdowns. The financial press said the piper will be paid.
You're going to get your face ripped off on this. Lehman Brothers is dead. Learn from Fannie, Freddie, Bear Stearns, all of them.
In her first big interview on ABC, Sarah Palin was pressed on her foreign policy experience and ticked off her qualifications.
And you can actually see Russia from land here in Alaska.
Favorite pudding, George.
And Hurricane Ike bears down on Texas. Here's one coastal resident south of Houston.
I'll tell you, it's rare this happens, but when it does, it's bad. And the way the storm's looking, it could basically end up leveling this whole section out here.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What did you make of Palin, the lipstick biz, the interview, the issues in play? With Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Lehman all fainting, are we better off or still in trouble? Republicans, Democrats, what do you make of this presidential campaign? Joining me now from Washington is Amy Sullivan, senior editor for Time Magazine. Amy, welcome back. Good to have you.
It's great to be here.
Joining us from Chicago is Steve Chapman, columnist and editorial page writer for the Chicago Tribune. Steve, great to have you back as well.
Thanks for having me.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Amy, and Steve.
Let's go straight to Sarah Palin's big interview, first real TV interview last night, exclusive with ABC News. Sarah Palin was asked by Charles Gibson about how she felt when McCain asked her to serve.
I didn't hesitate. No,
Doesn't that take some hubris?
I answered him yes, because I have the confidence in that readiness and knowing that you can't blink. You have to be wired in a way of being so committed to the mission that we're on, reform of this country and victory in the war. You can't blink. So I didn't blink then, even when asked to run as his running mate.
Sarah Palin with Charles Gibson last night. Amy Sullivan, you're in Washington. What did you think?
Well, I thought we saw a somewhat different Governor Palin than we have in the speeches that she's given both on the stump and at the Republican convention last week. She, not surprisingly for someone who is extremely new to the national political scene, was a little unsure of herself on a number of the answers, and given that ABC started with foreign policy, which was seen to be probably her weakest area, it perhaps wasn't surprising. The answer that's gotten the most attention has been, probably two of them. One was Charlie Gibson's question, clearly trying to get at whether she even knew what the Bush Doctrine was. And it was a little awkward to see her kind of fumble with that and end up giving an answer that was, in fact, not related or not a description of what the Bush Doctrine is. But the second thing was her response about whether the U.S. under NATO, if Georgia and Ukraine were invited into that pact, whether the U.S. would be drawn into war with Russia. And it was kind of a vague response, or perhaps so. But as we all
maybe
know,
maybe could be, maybe off we'd go.
The vagary doesn't fly very well on the diplomatic stage. And I think that was one of the clearest signs that she still is quite new to this. And she's obviously studying up. She's obviously being prepped very much by the McCain campaign. But that may not be enough for voters this year.
Steve Chapman, I want to hear you on this. For Palin supporters, I'm not sure how much the details matter. But let's listen to that exchange where in the ABC interview, being asked about some foreign policy questions, Charles Gibson threw the Bush Doctrine at her.
Do you agree with the Bush Doctrine?
In what respect, Charlie?
The Bush, well, what do you interpret it to be?
His worldview?
No, the Bush Doctrine, enunciated September 2002, before the Iraq War.
I believe that what President Bush has attempted to do is rid this world of Islamic extremism, terrorists who are hell-bent on destroying our nation. There have been blunders along the way, though. there have been mistakes made. And with new leadership, and that's the beauty of American elections, of course, and democracy, is with new leadership comes opportunity to do things better.
Sarah Palin last night on ABC with Charles Gibson. Steve, on foreign policy overall, what did you make of it? You've got a kind of conservative view there from Chicago. What did you make of her inaugural big interview?
Well, I don't want to be too hard on her, but I think listening to her and seeing what she had to say, it kind of illustrates that, you know, these are complicated issues, and you don't learn them in 2 weeks, and you don't learn them in 2 months. And I think the honest answer to Gibson's question, are you ready, is she's not. And I think it's going to be very hard for her to be ready by January 20th. You know, she obviously, you know, there's no reason she should have been a student of foreign policy and national security up to now, but she hasn't been, and she's now been put in a position where she could be entrusted with the ultimate responsibility for those very weighty matters in just a few months. You know, she could potentially be president, and I think anybody listening to that, watching that interview, who was on the fence, is going to feel like, you know, maybe that's not a great idea at this point.
Ready, she's not, you say, Steve, but thousands turn out very enthusiastic at her campaign appearances with John McCain. What are your fellow conservatives thinking, saying? Maybe you're out of step.
Well, that wouldn't be the first time, and I probably am. I think most conservatives feel like, you know, I think this is kind of who the Republican Party has stuck them with, to pardon the expression, and they're going to make the best of it. And I think their hope is she's going to have 4 years or 8 years to get fully up to speed, and you know, we'll never have to find out if she's ready to take over, you know, on a moment's notice from John McCain. But I think if you talk to the more honest conservative commentators out there, and particularly the ones who are best versed in national security and foreign policy, I think they would, you know, probably admit they've got some qualms about her.
Jack Beatty, step back here. Sarah Palin out on the big stage, big crowds, some doubts here, poll numbers way up for John McCain. What do you make of her coming out?
Well, she's been a political boom for McCain. There's no question about it. Suddenly, the base of the Republican Party is excited. Suddenly, a Barack Obama-sized crowds have been turning out for McCain's rallies, and it clearly has rejuvenated his campaign. What's good politically, however, is very questionable in terms of governance. I agree with everything Steve said, that there's nothing in her record, nothing in her presentation last night that would give one confidence that she is capable of becoming president of the United States, and that would make one feel anything other than trepidatious about that possibility.
Okay, but there she is, and it may give you trepidation, but presumably a lot of those thousands turning out for the rallies, Amy, let me put it to you, they must think, let's go. I mean, isn't that the sort of message being roared back to her from the crowd?
Well, those are the true believers, and there's no question that they've been energized by her selection as running mate for John McCain. But that was kind of a gap that McCain needed to make up. He had no chance of even being in the race when Republicans were so much less enthusiastic than Democrats are. But now the race is really going to turn to those swing voters, the independents, the moderate voters, who over the course of the last 8 years have moved closer and closer to Democrats, who have been more and more willing, particularly at the local level, to cross over and to support Democratic candidates. What we've seen going around to different battleground states, and just in the last few months I've been in Ohio and Pennsylvania and Michigan and Colorado, those Republicans who have been crossing over are precisely the ones who have been kind of very skittish about the social conservatives of the Sarah Palin mode. And they are unlikely to be drawn back to the McCain ticket simply because she is now part of it and, in fact, may feel even less enthusiastic about the Republican ticket because of that. So you may see that outweighed a bit, particularly among white conservative women who were seen move over to the Republicans a bit in the past week's polls. But we're really going to need to wait for another week or so for both bounces from both conventions to kind of die down and to see where we're really at with this campaign, because I think this week, right after the convention, you don't get a very clear and accurate snapshot of the campaign.
We're going to hear all the tape from Lipstick on a Pig, but Steve, let me ask you about the truth, honesty, lying spectrum of the conversation this week. People are saying Sarah Palin, let's say the bridge to nowhere, she's just stating things as fact repeatedly on the stump that are not true. Do you agree it's not true? She was for it before she was against it. Is that the truth? And if that is the truth, as a conservative, how do you square it with what this candidate is saying day after day on the stump?
I don't think you can square the two. From all the evidence I've seen, she was for it for quite a while. She only came out against it after it was clear it was not going to go through and that it was politically unpopular. And yet she does keep on saying, you know, she was opposed to it. And, you know, this is not the only incidents where the McCain campaign has been saying things that aren't true this week. And I have to say, you expect a certain amount of this in a presidential campaign. And there's been some nasty stuff from the left about Palin. I mean, there was somebody, a Democratic Party official in South Carolina, who said, you know, her only qualification is she didn't have an abortion. And you had a moderate liberal Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee who said she's a smug wacko. And but the difference is that the most of the nasty stuff is coming, you know, against Obama is coming directly from the McCain campaign, including some of the TV spots they ran this week, which were just about as dishonest as they could be.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Big bank trouble. Sarah Palin speaks. Interior Department scandal and Hurricane Ike moving in. Amy Sullivan from Time Magazine joins us from Washington. Steve Chapman with the Chicago Tribune joins us from Chicago. Our own Jack Beatty is here. Week started with a big flap over Lipstick and Pigs. Barack Obama speaking in Virginia used that phrase. Republicans seized on it as a sexist reference to Sarah Palin. In her acceptance speech, she had said the only difference between a pit bull and a hockey mom was Lipstick. Here's Obama's comment in context.
John McCain says he's about change, too. And so I guess his whole angle is, watch out, George Bush, except for economic policy, health care policy, tax policy, education policy, foreign policy, and Karl Rove-style politics, we're really going to shake things up in Washington. That's not change. That's just calling some the same thing something different. But, you know, you can put lipstick on a pig. It's still a pig.
And the McCain campaign went ballistic. Let's go to Pawcatuck, Connecticut, and Margaret. Margaret, you're on the air. What do you think?
Oh, yes. I think Obama delivered that exactly the way he did. I think he totally wanted the reaction of the crowd. As you could hear, they reacted because they knew they were making that noise against Sarah Palin.
You think it was a sexist dig at the governor?
Yeah, I definitely think he referenced the pig, the governor as a pig, because that's what he wanted to get across. Then later on, backtracked and said, "Oh no, that's not what I meant." But then, why did the crowd react that way? The crowd reacted that way because that's exactly how he delivered it.
What about the possibility? You may be right, but what about the possibility that they just agreed that John McCain was kind of dressing up his agenda to look like something that it wasn't? The lipstick on a pig. Phrase normally used in that way.
Well, I think Obama did exactly what he wanted to do. I think he wanted to put Sarah Palin down, use the pig comment in a different way than McCain did earlier.
Yeah,
about policies, but Obama was referring to Sarah Palin.
Margaret, let us look at it. Barack Obama spoke about it himself on Wednesday with David Letterman. He was asked about the lipstick comment.
Have you ever actually put lipstick on a pig?
You know,
whoops.
The answer would be no. But I think it might be fun to try.
Ah.
Do you I know the reaction to that was you are overreacting. You stand by that?
Absolutely. Yeah, look, this is if you this is sort of silly season in politics.
Mm-hmm.
Not that there's a non-silly season in politics.
That's right.
But it gets sillier.
Silly season, said Barack Obama. Amy Sullivan, our caller Margaret, says, you know, Barack Obama's a smart guy. He knew exactly what he was up to there and the kind of resonance around that comment. What do you think, Amy?
Well, there are two things there. One is, as she referenced, John McCain is fond of this phrase himself and, in fact, used it earlier in the campaign season in reference to Hillary Clinton in almost the same kind of situation, saying, you know, she says her policies are one thing, but you can't dress them up this way. The second thing is that you actually cut off the clip a little early when
Whoops.
You played it.
Mm-hmm.
He followed the lipstick on a pig phrase with another metaphor, and I'm mm-hmm. losing the exact words, but it was something like you can wrap a dead fish in paper, but
That's
it's still
right.
a dead fish.
Still stinks.
And the crowd reacted the same way. He was just kind of, you know, grasping for a way to describe his belief that the McCain policies are, in fact, very similar to Bush policies, just under a different sort of name and under a change rubric. So I actually think this is one situation where a lot of Republicans are getting quite righteously upset over not a lot. And frankly, it has not made me terribly proud of my profession this week to see how much this has dominated headlines, particularly when we've actually had quite serious things going on in the news.
And if I may point out that in that speech, but in an earlier speech, even in more detail, Barack Obama laid out a comprehensive program for the reform of American education, from kindergarten, from really preschool, early childhood education, to college. Mm. He advocated a $10 billion program for early childhood education, which has effectively been written by a Nobel Prize-winning economist at the University of Chicago. These are a major idea, and yet what are we talking about? Lipstick on a pig. You know, it reminds one of what James Joyce said of life. It's an intensely serious low comedy. This week, this was an intensely serious low comedy. And the McCain campaign, Rick Davis, the campaign manager, said the campaign is not about issues. It's about personalities and cultural matters. Well, that's exactly what the Republicans want to do. They want to create noise. And that's what the pig metaphor gave them, a chance to create noise, drowning out this major education program that Obama announced.
And the days tick by to the election. Let's go to Des Moines, Iowa, and Susan. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a middle-aged woman, and I'm independent. The reason I'm independent is because I don't like being affiliated with any party. I just judge the individuals. I did, though. I am leaning Democrat, and I voted for Kerry in the last campaign. What concerns me is, kind of not to reiterate what you're talking about, but the swaying of the ignorant, you know, masses. I think Sarah Palin kind of personifies a lack of careful consideration before acting, which has been exemplified by the Bush administration. When she says things like, I didn't even blink and I made a decision, well, that's scary, and also it's exemplified in her personal life. I mean, when you choose to have a child over 40 years old, the chances of having one with Down syndrome is like more than 30%.
But a lot of people have done that, and she did it and stood up by the consequences. And let me ask you, Susan, when you say swaying the ignorant masses, who are you talking about? Your fellow Americans? Your fellow voters?
What I'm talking about with ignorant masses is just what your last commentator was talking about. Not talking about issues, but talking about, let's distract from personalities. Like the lipstick on a pig was ridiculous, but it's also ridiculous to keep saying, you know, to put this woman with so little experience up. She doesn't do fact checking before she speaks. That's ignorant. It's ignorant to, you know, maybe it's a little reckless if you already have four children and you're the governor, to have a fifth child.
Susan, we've got the perspective. Steve Chapman, let me bring it to you. It seems to me that that kind of characterization of lots of other Americans as ignorant masses is part of what is driving people out to Palin rallies to support her, saying, you can't treat us that way. And that's being clearly fired up by the McCain campaign, but people really resonate with that. You can't talk about us like that.
No, I think you're right, and I think they have a right to be upset, and I think you know, they have a right to be resentful that, people criticize Sarah Palin for you know, the number of kids she has and what age she was when she had them. I don't think that has anything to do with her fitness to be vice president or president. And it's really strange to hear people on the left you know, telling a woman what she ought to be doing with her personal life before she's entitled to, hold office.
Let's go to Jim in Birmingham, Alabama. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Tim.
Tim, sorry.
I'm a McCain supporter, and my question is, listening to you guys, is what were the qualifications, if we go back to Bill Clinton, governor of Arkansas, to be president, and he had a – I'm a McCain supporter, so I said Clinton obviously had a very successful 8 years. A lot of things went into that. Here we're talking about the number two on the ticket. Granted, she doesn't have the background that some senators or other statesmen may have, but it's something you'll learn, and you'll learn as an understudy instead of as Bill Clinton came in as the top of the ticket, and you have to learn. And it. And I'm always of an opinion, even though I'm supporting McCain, governors make better presidents. For all the reasons people are saying that she's qualified, whether it's Democrat or Republican, I just feel like governors have a better grasp of the real world that we live in, where a senator is living a bubble.
But Tim, let me ask you then, if governors make better presidents, and certainly Americans have gone that way many times, and Bill Clinton had been repeatedly elected, lost, reelected, reelected as governor of Arkansas, had served for a long time.
He was elected twice.
A lot more than the year plus or going on 2 years that Sarah Palin's
right.
in. Just
Grant,
factually.
Grant.
So what's, I mean, what's the problem? Is there a point at which qualifications become too low for you? She's governor for less than 2 years of a state with under a million people.
They do become too low, but I think you've got to look beyond that. You've got to look more into, believe, the personalities of the individuals, the strengths of the individuals. No, I don't think she's ready to run for president, but I don't think many people are ready to be president. And unfortunately, as a society, we tend to make the elections a beauty contest, because if you go back and look at both parties, there are individuals in both parties that are probably more qualified than McCain or Obama. But television presented us two options in each party in most cases, and we as a society tend to follow along, and I include myself in that. But
so it's never just about qualifications. There's more at play, and we see that. But you're still ready to come down with Palin, and we've got it. Thanks for calling, Tim. Let's go to Hampstead, New Hampshire. And Bruce, you're on the air.
Hello there.
Hi.
I was a McCain supporter for a long, long time. I guess I'm giving away my point here already. Living in New Hampshire, I've had a chance to meet him on a couple of different occasions during primaries, and was really impressed with the straight talk approach and feeling that he was a very, very genuine candidate, someone I could really trust and felt would always make the right decision, and I trusted. But I feel that in this campaign, since the end of the primary, I see McCain making, shall we say, a pact with the dark side, doing whatever it takes to become elected. I see it in things like the comment on the on lipstick on a pig. I don't think very many people would be as upset about it if the McCain campaign hadn't really planted that idea. I think Obama's point that the lipstick was Palin.
So you're leaning away.
Yeah. But now I've lost it with the McCain campaign because of the choice of Palin. I think, you know, this is the last straw for me as someone who has always considered myself to be a Republican. This is, to me, clearly a candidate who is not ready to step in and become our next president. And the performance last night with that interview really put the nail in the coffin for me.
Bruce, thanks for calling. Jack Beatty, there's a pro and a con on McCain-Palin. And the days tick down to the election. What do you see here? There's always gut and, you know, mind at work in election politics and decisions. Polls drifting John McCain's way, though, in this last week.
They are. There's no question about it. And the John McCain that our caller was originally, Bruce was originally for, was on display last night in an interview on MSNBC about public service in America. There was McCain, witty, self-deprecating, generous toward the opposition, praising Barack Obama's community activism, a genuinely affectionate reference to Senator Kennedy, statesmanlike, not vaunting the United States as the best country in the world, but saying, you know, what we do well, we should be proud of it. Boy, what's to object to there? And yet the candidate, the campaign he's running, I think Paul Krugman doesn't exaggerate when he says that lately it's become a blizzard of lies, that this is his advertising, the kinds of the sorts of things they're putting out in statements. McCain wrote in one of his autobiographies, "I have never been able to distinguish my reputation as a man from my reputation as a politician. Deficiencies in the executions of my public responsibilities are deficiencies in my character and burden my conscience." This campaign he's running must burden his conscience, because it's a even by American political standards, it's a low campaign. When you have the Associated Press even asserting as a factual matter that his latest ad about Obama and sex education is false.
Sex education in kindergarten, that assertion.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. You've got problems. He's running a campaign that is against everything he has said he stands for in American politics.
Let's hear John McCain in his own words at that forum on service last night in New York City. Barack Obama there also. McCain said he would have done things differently after 9/11 if he'd been president.
I would have created organizations ranging from neighborhood block watch to making sure that our nuclear power plants are secure to immediately proposing to Congress legislation such as Senator Evan Bayh and I proposed of service to country to create additional organizations to expand AmeriCorps, expand Peace Corps, expand the military. Obviously, we were facing a new threat.
Sarah Palin says she wouldn't blink. John McCain says he would have done things differently. Barack Obama also spoke about the meaning of 9/11 for him.
And I think of that spirit after the tragedy had occurred, how the outpouring of patriotism, emotion, volunteerism, the desire for service was in the minds of everyone.
Amy Sullivan, very much on the same page in this, you know, day of what do they call it, ceasefire in campaigning there at a forum on service. But outside of that bubble of peace, pretty tough, pretty sharp elbows this week.
Absolutely. You know, the John McCain that we saw last night is the McCain who everybody used to know and love. And Jack put his finger exactly on the problem, but also the opportunity, I think, for the Obama campaign. The strategy they have got to take is to tie this McCain image that he is obviously projecting in public forums, he's going to project in the debates, we can predict that now, to the kind of campaign that he's running, and to say, you know, you can judge a man by what he says or you can judge a man by what he does. And what he has done since running for president this time around has switched from opposing the Bush tax cuts to now supporting the Bush tax cuts. He moved from opposing the Bush position on torture to coming somewhat closer to it from his earlier very principled stand. You can see from the ads that he's run what kind of a campaign he is choosing to wage. And I certainly agree with the caller from New Hampshire that I think for a lot of voters, his selection of Palin really says more about him and his judgment and his decision making than it does about herself.
But they're flocking to these people. They're flocking to this ticket in the polls.
Again, those are the true believers who are coming home to roost. Yeah. But we haven't seen any movement among independents.
Yeah. Which margin it's about, the election will show us. Amy Sullivan, Steve Chapman, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. It's been a week of highs and lows with Wall Street quaking and the presidential fight taking up a lot of oxygen. Funny man Jay Leno noted some weird changes in the U.S. economy with Lehman Brothers, Fannie, and Freddie all in trouble.
See, I knew the mortgage industry was in trouble when I went to buy a wedding gift for a friend of mine a couple of weeks ago. I bought a toaster. They gave me a bank. That's how bad it was. Hey, I tell you that.
David Letterman said he understood Sarah Palin's first television interview was quite an event.
Seriously, the interview went very well, and during the interview, Sarah Palin actually gave birth to her sixth child. So it was, she can do it all. She's ready to go.
And country music singer Aaron Tippin put up his political flag on Sean Hannity's radio show with this Drill Baby Drill number. Drill here, drill now.
And the damage already done has been a mighty heavy toll. And if we're gonna fix it, we gotta start right here at home. Drill here, drill now.
In case you missed the message, Emmy Sullivan of Time Magazine joins us. Steve Chapman of the Chicago Tribune and Jack Beatty, you can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? It started off with a bang on the bank's front Monday. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson told CBS, the early show, that the way Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae had been run had created a mess.
This was a flawed business model in the first place. Never should have happened. Great ambiguities, a big conflict between public purpose and private profit, systemic risk.
Systemic risk and now billions in public money at risk behind those banks to keep them going. Let's hear about that from Roanoke, Virginia. Lee, you're on the air. What do you think, Lee?
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would submit that what we're seeing now with Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and Lehman Brothers and just the whole financial malaise started shortly after World War II with the increased permissiveness of the American culture. Prior to World War II, if I'm looking for a benchmark time frame, the daddy had no problem taking young child out behind the woodpile and letting him know what was right and wrong. After World War II, because of that that trauma to the American psyche, my child is going to have everything they want. Let's get more permissive. Let's and as we go on and on and on. Game Boys, the whole malaise. I think you know what I'm talking about.
You mean here. then it was daddy and the kids, and now it's the government and the banks? Is that the parallel you're drawing, Lee?
Yeah, I think that's the point I'm trying to make. We have become such a permissive culture that when Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were created, the idea was very good, but what did not happen was the accountability to follow along to make sure that they were checks and balances to keep us out of this kind of mess.
It's an interesting point, and with the Republican presidency in particular, Steve Chapman, I want to get you on that, but let's get one more call first on from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I'm surprised people, you know, I know there's an election, but, you know, people ought to be really concerned about what the Fed and Treasury is doing with taxpayer money. In the last 3 months, if you add up the stuff we know, it's probably on the order of $2 trillion, and that's not counting stuff like all the paper that the Fed accepted at their TISLIF window for Lehman. Those guys would have been BK months ago.
If BK not, bankrupt.
Mm-hmm. They are bankrupt for all intents and purposes, and the only thing floating them is the Fed accepting worthless paper. This is a huge burden on the American taxpayer for something that can't be prevented anyway. People, the reason that paper is worthless, home values are falling, people are walking away. They're better off because, you know, they don't have their debt burden anymore. In a few years, they can buy cheaper homes. But the people that are being bailed out are the investors in all this paper, and that's what you're seeing happening with this TISLIF window and now with
this is the open lending by the federal government to banks in a pickle. Yeah,
is so what you're seeing now is that the taxpayers and especially young taxpayers are going to be footing the bill. They're instead of just letting these people go bankrupt that are bankrupt, they're keeping this whole thing afloat. And so when they want to buy a home, things are still artificially inflated longer, and they've got it. They'll either have a huge tax burden to pay for this stuff, or the value of the dollar will have to go down.
Steve, you're following closely, and we're glad for that. Let us pick it up, Steve Chapman. Here's Steve saying, you know, all this easy money is going to have a huge price. And you heard Lee in Roanoke, Virginia say this is a, what, permissive culture run amok now right here into the markets and government bailouts. How do you look at what's going on with the banks, Steve? Hank Paulson is a savvy guy. Is this necessary? Is it irresponsible? How do you look at it?
I think in the case of Fannie Mae, this is not a new obligation. This is just a bill that's been out there for a long time that finally came due. For a long time, the federal government had implicitly guaranteed the loans provided by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and there were a lot of economists who said, there's going to come a day when things are going to go bad, and you're going to have to make good on that promise. And things have gone bad, and the government is having to do it. And I think it's very unfortunate. It's a terrible thing when the federal government has to bail out even quasi-private corporations. But if you talk to even very staunch free market economists about this, they say there was really no choice. I talked to one yesterday, who said, if it had not, stepped in with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, you would have had a worldwide financial crisis on a scale that you haven't seen since the Great Depression. And in reference to the caller who said, that's a product of permissive culture, we did have a pretty huge financial panic back in the 1920s before that.
So it's not as if we haven't been here before. On the other hand, we thought we patched up that ship after the Depression and learned something there. Jack Beatty, here we are at the end of a big free market period. Bailouts right, left, and center. We're going to devote a whole show to it on Monday. But what do you see happening here, Jack?
Well, I think that that the President Bush deserves some credit here for his appointment of Paulson. I mean, the man clearly has the confidence of the markets, and he's talked.
Came from Goldman Sachs. Came from Lehman Brothers. Home turf on Wall Street.
That's right, and it couldn't have been better timed in that regard, because so much of this is confidence. And he's talked the president into what is, for a Republican administration, a hard step for the takeover of these institutions, the government intervention in other matters. But it's a victory, it seems to me, of pragmatism over ideology. And part of the original problem was the ideology, the hands-off, let anything go. View that prevailed at the Fed and in the administration, and which, if it wasn't the prime factor in this mortgage meltdown crisis, it certainly powerfully contributed to it.
Amy Sullivan, what about Jack says maybe this is a necessary confidence-restoring step. Do you see confidence being restored out there? Prominent economists saying this week maybe we're only halfway into this finance issue. The broader economy, bad retail numbers again today, bad numbers on other fronts. You've been out in Michigan, Amy. Do you see confidence being restored in the U.S. economy?
I absolutely do not. And I think it's always important to remember that there's quite a gap between what economists may see in the economy, and they may be very right about that. I think Steve made a very good point that this was not a shocking move in terms of Fannie Mae, and it may not even have that much of an impact in terms of the daily lives.
May I just interject there? It was shocking in that everybody had known there was this quasi-informal standing behind these outfits, but it was never supposed to come to this. I mean, this is a failure. This is what was not supposed to happen. They were supposed to be managed soberly so that this never occurred.
Well, and I think that the impact is that it just exacerbates the existing crisis of confidence that a lot of voters have about the economy right now and how this administration in particular has managed it, whether that's earned or unearned by them. But just to get back to, how it's playing on the ground, Michigan has been the state hit hardest of any in the country by
job
the
losses. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Job losses. The auto industries just are not recovering at all. Foreclosure rates are through the roof in that state. And they're really suffering. It's my home state, and my mother does canvassing every day for the Obama campaign. And she calls me with her daily updates on the voters, and she reports, nobody here cares about lipstick. Nobody here is paying attention to the back and forth. They are hurting. They're losing their homes. They're working as many hours as they can because they know there's a good chance they'll get laid off next month. And I think that's really important to bear in mind just in terms of the political implications here. We may be hearing a lot about culture wars. We may be hearing about negative ads. But at the end of the day, this may be an election that's very much like 1992, which is to say it's still the economy, stupid. And voters are going to be listening very carefully, particularly in the debates, to hear what both sides have to offer them in terms of solutions, or at least a way forward, given the mess that we're in right now.
Obama up a couple points in Michigan, at least in one recent poll. But Steve Chapman, how do you look at this overall? McCain, John McCain and Sarah Palin talking about change now. There's the economy with all of its troubles. Clearly change needed. Can McCain... You know, he's gained with the religious right. He's gained with pumped-up conservatives who do like Sarah Palin a lot. Can he make a persuasive case on the economy that he's got a new direction, Steve?
I think he's going to have a hard time on the economy because it hasn't. Things have not gone well, and you've got a housing bust, and that's painful for a lot of people. But I don't think that means that McCain can't win the election because this is, you know, we are still at war, and I think that's his strong point. And I think... you know, the fact that he's doing so well in the polls has to give Democrats a lot of concern. And, you know, you would think, given the objective factors at work this year, it would be impossible for the Democrats to lose. But I don't think we can rule that out.
I'm trying to muddle through where you stand now, Steve. You were pretty critical at the top of the hour about the McCain campaign, but I think of you as a pretty solid Republican. Where do you personally stand, in your view, as a columnist on the candidates?
Well, I disagreed with McCain on Iraq and on Iran, and I think his judgment has been wrong again and again on those issues. And I don't relish the idea of a liberal Democrat in the White House with a Democratic Congress, but I think that may be the least bad of the options right now.
So you're almost over onto that independent fence. Duly noted. Let's get a call from Bellingham, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. Great panel and great show as usual. Your music snippet there, Drill Baby Drill, was my call to action today, and I'd just like to remind you all, about 3 years ago you had a show where you had pro-drillers and pro-environmentalists about ANWR, and
yes,
as much as those two groups disagreed, they agreed on one thing, and that was that even in the wildest, most optimistic drilling expectations throughout this country, not just ANWR, that we'd only increase our output of about 3%, and that clearly the solution is not drilling. The solution is conservation. And here we are. It's like deja vu all over again, but this time we're throwing caution to the wind and drill, baby, drill. So I'll just throw that back to your panel and listen to your comments.
Good. Jim, thanks very much. Drill here, drill now, sang the country singer there. Steve, let me come once more to you. This has been picked up now, the drill, baby, drill part of it, and McCain's drill here, drill now, as a kind of chant on the Republican campaign circuit. Interpret that.
It may not be a bad idea, but it's not going to make a difference in production or prices anytime soon. There was a report out the other day from the American Enterprise Institute, which is a conservative think tank in Washington, and they, you know, looked at the possibilities for more production and exploration in the areas that are now off limits, and they said, you know, ultimately you might get a 1% improvement in production. That's not going to make very much difference to the average person.
And now you have the Democrats completely caving on this, led by Nancy Pelosi, who was a staunch opponent of offshore drilling. They're now strictly on political grounds supporting it. And it's a cave. And really, you know, it shows something very, I think, ominous about the future in regard to climate change. We all know that the price of energy has got to go up to change our behavior. And yet at the first shock of this $4 gas, admittedly very hard to take, both parties have just stopped the, you know, they're going to go for this offshore drilling, which will mean nothing. They're all the effort to push the price down again. And that's a very bad sign about the public's unwillingness and the political system's unwillingness to accept the necessary changes, even the necessary pain we're going to have to endure in order to get to a situation where the biosphere can be preserved.
Another head-turning headline here, and a bit of tape on the oil front and resources front. Interior Department Inspector General found a, quote, culture of ethical failure, unquote, among among staff in Denver with the Minerals Management Service. They collect about $10 billion a year on royalties in resource management. The scandal involves sex, cocaine, and oil. Here's Senator Ben Nelson of Florida on the findings.
The government employees who oversee offshore oil drilling are literally and figuratively in bed with big oil.
Amy Sullivan, that whole story was kind of a mind blower. I mean, you've got all kinds of gifts from the energy companies and sexual misconduct, cocaine use. What is going on out there?
Just when you thought political news couldn't get any more interesting this fall. Yes, we get this story this week. And you have to think that for somebody like George W. Bush, who always has his eye on his legacy, that this is not exactly what he wants coming out within his administration, even though he does not appear to have had anything to do with it. But, you know, it's starting to wind down, and people are starting to write their histories of the George W. Bush years. This just kind of plays into the idea that there was more emphasis on putting loyal people in positions of power instead of competent, experienced bureaucrats who know how to run government agencies. And I think that, again, plays into the lack of confidence that a lot of people have about government.
Storms in politics, Hurricane Ike still barreling in, and we're thinking of people on the Texas coast there. Jack Beatty, last thoughts at the end of this week on the campaign. Is this going to be the flavor here on out to November 4th, this kind of back and forth? Or, you know, can we get on top of the energy question, on top of the education question, right on down the list?
Well, you know, Chris Matthews has, I think, half facetiously, half seriously suggested that McCain doesn't know what's going on in his own campaign. And that once he realizes the kind of campaign they're running, he's going to be the real John McCain and talk about the issues. Well, let's see.
maybe. Steve Chapman, still on the fence there in Chicago at this point, then.
None of this would be happening if John McCain had gotten the nomination.
Wait a minute. There it goes. It's an elusive character, but we'll keep track of it. Steve Chapman with the Chicago Tribune. Always great to have you. Thank you very much for being here, Steve.
Thank you.
Amy Sullivan at Time Magazine, thanks so much for joining us, Amy.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
And Jack, have a great weekend. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.